Hello, this is Terrence McNally. The following interview with Joe Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund, author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, was recorded Sunday, April 23rd. Friday, April 28th, headlines, quote, President Donald Trump saying there is a chance that we could end up having a major, major conflict with North Korea.
Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to the sixth newly recorded episode of Free Forum in 2017. I'm going to be joined today by Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of a number of books, one of them Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. And that's what we will be talking about. We will be talking about nuclear weapons and the various escalated threats and provocations that are in the news these days. After hosting and producing this show weekly for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews. And since then, I've dug into the archives to stream what I feel is one of the best relevant earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. But podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes and at my site, terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. But following the election of Donald Trump, I cannot resist exploring our path forward and in confronting him and his administration. On Free Forum, we've always explored the lives, work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. So first off today, I want to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in the resistance to Trump and the movement toward healthy, progressive future we so desperately need. And I must say, I and thousands of people marched yesterday in defense of science. And the idea that we would be marching in defense of science in the 21st century is, you couldn't have told me that in junior high, high school, college, or maybe even 2 weeks. No, 2 weeks ago you could have, but a year ago maybe you couldn't have. But I found it a very, if you will, refreshing demonstration. I have a feeling that a lot of these people do not demonstrate regularly. They spend their time in their labs doing their work face down. And so the numbers of young people, the numbers of actual people who practice science out on the streets yesterday was inspiring. Here's a few websites for information on how to actively participate. IndivisibleGuide.com, Indivisible Guide, one word. OurRevolution.com, which is the kind of the current incarnation of the Bernie Sanders campaign. CourageCampaign.org in California. MoveOn.org nationally. FiveCalls.org, which is what are some calls you could make each week. And TownHallProject.com, which tells you who of your representatives might be holding town halls in your area and how to attend. So we're recording this interview Sunday, April 23rd, and here are just some headlines from the past 4 days, right? North Korea threatens to launch nuclear attack on Australia. China wants nuclear weapons eliminated in Korea. Nuclear-capable Russian bombers fly near the U.S. to intimidate America. And this one from Fox News, group claims Iran is in full gear on covert work on nuclear weapons. The Trump administration will review the Iran nuclear deal despite compliance. That came out this week. Charles Krautheimer, his headline is Crisis with North Korea Requires Action. And from the UK's Independent, what would happen if Trump went to war with North Korea? And finally, UN voices fears of catastrophic nuclear accident as global tensions increase. How did we get here? Remember 2015 when the big nuclear weapons news was the deal negotiated by the Obama administration with Iran? Sure, North Korea is always doing and saying something provocative, with the only thing that keeps them from being Albania. And one can always worry about who's buying what on the global dark market for weapons technology. But why is the UN voicing fears of catastrophe? What role is the new Trump administration playing in the escalation of provocation? And are the UN's fears real? And if so, what can we do about it? And I feel lucky to have landed an interview with today's guest, Joe Cirincione, for a timely conversation about all of this. Joe Cirincione joined the Plowshares Fund as president in March 2008. He previously served as senior vice president for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress and as director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and his newest, Nuclear Nightmare, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. Welcome again, Joe Cirincione, to Free Forum.
Well, thank you, Terrence. A pleasure to be here.
As you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we're going to deal with. So could you talk a bit about your path to the work you do today? You could mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. When did you get into the nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction field? How did that happen, and how did you end up where you are today?
Well, this was back in the 1980s. I had come down to Washington to go to grad school at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, got a degree there, met a professor. He got appointed to the Reagan administration, so my first job was actually in the Reagan administration. He hired me to be a special assistant, and we were working on Central America. We were working on general security issues, but I had always leaned towards the bigger strategic issues, particularly the nuclear balance. So after a stint at the Carnegie Endowment, working more generally, I got hired as a staffer on the House Armed Services Committee in the mid-1980s. And this was a point of extreme crisis. You may remember the last time we had a mass movement, anything like what we're seeing now, was in the 1980s, when the biggest demonstration in U.S. history up until the Women's March happened in 1982, when a million people went to Central Park to protest nuclear weapons. The U.S. and the Soviet Union were rushing weapons, new weapons, into Europe, heightening their strategic competition. A lot of people thought we would blow up the world. There was this famous TV show the day after that vividly illustrated what would happen. And I was assigned as a staffer on the House Armed Services Committee, oversight over a number of the nuclear programs, including the famous Star Wars program, the Strategic Defense Initiative, this missile defense effort. And it became pretty clear to me that, one, missile defense doesn't work, that this was more about contracts and ideology than it was about actual capability, and that we had way more nuclear weapons than we ever needed. And the members I was working for felt the same way. So I was deeply involved in oversight and crafting legislation and understanding the strategies and in trying to rein in the arms race. And that pretty much stayed with me as I went to think tanks in Washington and now as president of the Plowshares Fund. And I still maintain government connections. I'm on the International Security Advisory Board to the Secretary of State. So I advised Secretary Clinton and then Secretary Kerry. And much to my surprise, apparently I'm still on it. I thought that had ended, but I found out this week that no, I still have a security clearance. There technically is still the same ISAB. I don't know if Secretary Tillerson knows that he's got an advisory board. He hasn't asked me for my advice. So
that's,
I'm happy
right.
on your podcast to give some advice to Secretary Tillerson
right.
directly.
Okay, let's lay out some basics, Joe, just to ground this before we get to specifics. Which mm-hmm. countries today do we know have nuclear weapons?
There are 9 countries, and almost in order, and if you want to know the details of this, you can go to our website, plowshares.org, spelled the English way, P-L-O-U-G-H, plowshares, and we have a stockpile report, so it'll show you the details of this. But the two big guys are the U.S. and Russia, and that's the way it's always been. They have about 7,000 weapons each total. About 4,000 of those are in the active stockpile. So the United States and Russia both have 4,000 nuclear weapons ready to go, and then others in various reserve hedge funds, and actually call that, it's a hedge in case you have to upload more. And the rest of the world then splits up the 1,000 or so that's left over. There's 15,000 total. And so you have France, which has about 350. United Kingdom has, about 160. China has about 200. India and Pakistan then come in with about 120 each. Israel has, depends how you count them, and this is the most secretive of the programs, but about 80. And then you get down to North Korea. And North Korea has enough material for around 15 to 20 nuclear bombs. It's unclear how many they've actually built. So they're the newest member of the nuclear club, and that's it. There are other people that have had programs or even had weapons, but interestingly, more countries have given up nuclear weapons or programs over the last 30 years than have tried to get them. So right now, this nuclear club is fairly stable. There are no new countries knocking on the door. The two problem states you have there that people sometimes call outlaw states or rogue states are North Korea, which has enough weapons, and Iran, which doesn't have any weapons. And their program was recently dealt with, as you mentioned, diplomatically, rolling it back and freezing it.
Mm-hmm. Freezing it for 10 years. When does that freeze come off, 2025?
Well, there are some relatively minor restrictions that come off in 10 years. So they can start doing research on advanced centrifuges, things like that. But the real hard restrictions last 15 years. And that limits how many centrifuges they could have. These are the machines that can make the material for either fuel rods or bombs. These are the machines that make highly enriched uranium, either for fuel or bombs. And once you take the limits off, they can then start deploying more. They could do advanced designs. They could start enriching to higher levels. So the real limits is 15. The limits, the prohibitions on acquiring a nuclear weapon are permanent. Those never come off. The intrusive inspection regime that we imposed on Iran is permanent. That never goes off. So if you heard Secretary Tillerson, this is my first piece of advice to him, if you heard Secretary Tillerson say in recent weeks that Iran will then be able, when the limits come off, will then be able to build a bomb, no, that's not true. They are expressly prohibited, and there are other treaties that they're part of that also prohibited them. So there's no truth to the fact that we will then be allowing them to go get a bomb in 15 years. It's quite the opposite.
Interesting. I will say to you, Joe, and I'm sure I'm not the first one to say this, that having observed the recent presidential election, debates, articles, all of that, the impression or the myth that this deal only limited for 10 years was seemed to me to make it through the media.
Oh, absolutely. This is the problem you have, and this is the problem you have with a very skilled propaganda campaign that's supported by one, you know, right-wing organizations whose agenda is really to start a war with Iran. They want to overthrow the regime, and so they want to use the nuclear issue, the nuclear scare, as a reason for that. And two, when you have an entire network like Fox News repeating this over and over again, and then you have a presidential candidate like Donald Trump repeating it over and over again. Well, it's no wonder most of the population, you know, thinks that, one, we gave them a ton of money, and now they're using that to finance terrorists. Not true. Two, that this is a lousy deal, and it only lasts for 10 years. Not true. And that, three, this was the worst deal ever negotiated, or a very bad deal. Not true. This is actually one of the strongest, best nuclear security agreements I've ever seen. It's very detailed, incredible inspection and verification mechanisms built in. Iran gave up a lot. The core of the truth is that they didn't give up everything. You know, what you would really want is to just, you know, scrape the earth like Carthage, you know, just clean it off. Well, no, you couldn't get that deal. So they retain a fraction of their capability, but it's still a fraction, and the limits don't last forever. So the trick is what you do with the time you just bought. If you've got 15 years, what do you do then? What's the next agreement that you can put in place? How can you supplement that? Trump could go negotiate other side agreements to this if he wants to fix it. The Iranians are open to that. They're about as transactional as Trump is. So if he wants them to do more, if he offers them more sanctions relief, for example, more U.S. business deals, for example, the Iranians are willing to do more. We'll see if he takes that path.
Sticking with Iran, Iran still has the right to develop nuclear power?
Yes.
Yeah.
They have the only power reactor in the Middle East, this reactor they built first with West Germany and then with Russia at Bushehr on the Persian Gulf.
And so, and that was something they wanted all along. And I must say, when I speak to Iranian immigrants in Los Angeles, basically they say everyone in Iran, moderates, pro-Westerners, everyone defends their right to have nuclear power, and that they retained. The distinction here is the kind of work you would do with nuclear energy to form weapons.
Absolutely. So the U.S. originally opposed that deal, but then dropped that opposition basically during the Bush administration. And in truth, because we didn't want this to be a cover for getting nuclear weapons. And so they can have the power reactor. They actually would like to build more. There are other countries in the Middle East who want to build more. And there is some economic sense to that. It is, you know, why burn your oil for electricity when you can sell it for currency, particularly if that's your major export?
Yeah.
So you can do that, and you can get the fuel for that reactor the way other countries who have reactors get the fuel. You buy it from the handful of countries that make it. So in this case, Russia is more than happy to sell the fuel rods, sell the fuel to Russia. In fact, that is the deal they have with Bashir. And reactors are a lot like printers. The money's in the cartridges. The real money is in the fuel, selling the fuel for 30, 40 years for these reactors. So Russia is not really interested in Iran having its own capability to make fuel, and that was the nub of the problem. The very same machines, the centrifuges that Iran says it wants to make low-enriched uranium for fuel, can also be used to make high-enriched uranium for bombs. Do you trust them? Clearly, we don't. The rest of the world didn't. And that's why you had six nations, including Russia and China, negotiating this deal with Iran. And that's what makes this deal so strong.
Right. And by the way, that is one of the facts which I think if we went out on the street right now and asked people, they would not know and would say, no, this is a deal that we made with them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think so. They don't know that this was an international set of all the most powerful countries in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So it sounds like what you said is we've got a 15-year window here in which we can either work toward the kind of elimination we want or we can actually do things vis-a-vis Iran that make it more likely that they would reinvigorate their program when 15 years are up. And that's kind of a question. Now, one other thing is there is an election upcoming in Iran.
May 19th.
Yeah, May 19th, very soon. And the former Ahmadinejad has announced that he's running. Now, I didn't realize when he announced, it seemed to me within the last 2 weeks that the election was that close. But I guess only America has elections that last forever.
That's right. And you know, it's... You wouldn't know this from America's image of Iran, but Iran is actually a democracy in large part. It has free, it has elections, but it's limited. And this is, you know, there's a really only Israel is the real democracy in the Middle East. That's a free and open system. But Iran, you know, is better than almost all the Sunni Arab states in the region. And these elections often produce winners that are unexpected. But here's the catch. The candidates, the number of candidates who can run are limited. The supreme leader rules, basically, on who gets to run and who doesn't.
Yeah, and not so just the number, but who, right?
Yeah, who. Yeah. So yesterday, the day before we're recording this, the supreme leader ruled out Ahmadinejad. So he is not allowed to run again for president. So he's out. The current president, Rouhani, largely considered a pragmatist. Some would say a moderate, but there aren't that many moderates in Iran. He's a pragmatist. He's still favored to win re-election, but you just don't know. Iranian elections are full of surprises.
Yeah, now that's interesting to me. As I said, I hadn't gotten the last bit of news you just shared, which is that Ahmadinejad was banned by the supreme leader, but it means that it isn't just a moderate who would be banned, that he actually picks and chooses.
Yeah, when he was elected, he was not the regime's candidate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Rouhani was elected 5 years ago, or 4 years ago, he was not the regime's candidate, but he overwhelmingly was the people's candidate, and for precisely this reason, the people of Iran want a more pragmatic, more moderate course, someone who's open to making deals with the West, and that's what Rouhani promised.
That's funny. They tried their populist.
Yeah.
Ahmadinejad was their populist, and they decided it didn't work. Anything else about the situation in Iran before we move on?
The nuclear program is under control. The Secretary of State just certified this last week that Iran is complying with the deal. The International Atomic Energy Agency does inspections all the time. We have people on site. They're complying. There is not a nuclear threat. They're not cheating. They're not breaking it. The issue is really over Iran's role in the Middle East, like their aid for Assad, propping up Assad in Syria, or their backing of the Houthis, the ethnic group in Yemen, which is now involved in a war with Saudi Arabia, or their support for Hamas and Hezbollah. And that's why you hear the State Department come out and say basically that they're the cause of all evil in the Middle East. And there's real talk about pushing back. So the real threat to the deal isn't that Iran's going to break it or the U.S. will break it. It's that the U.S. is so intent on pushing Iran back into a box that it will lead to a confrontation. Remember, the U.S. ships in the Persian Gulf operate a few miles away from Iranian ships in the Gulf. And in that close proximity, and same in Iraq, we have U.S. forces in Iraq that are fighting or helping the fighting not far from Iranian forces. We now have U.S. combat forces in Syria. So there's a number of flashpoints where if tensions rise between the two countries, it could trigger an exchange of fire. It could trigger actual combat between U.S. and Iranian forces. And then it's off to the races, and the nuclear deal could become collateral damage in that bigger conflict.
And it seems to me, I recall during the negotiation of the Iranian deal or discussion post-negotiation, that the right and the more hawkish say we shouldn't just have made it about sanctions. We should have put these other things on the table. And if they wanted to go ahead with the deal, they would have had to give up some of that terror, sponsor of terrorism, et cetera.
Well, we didn't do that for two reasons. Three, actually. One, the most serious threat was the Iranian nuclear program. That was the biggest national security threat to the United States. The other things we don't like, but they don't represent a fundamental and existential threat to the United States, too. It is just way too complicated to try and negotiate all these things at once. There was no way the U.S. and Iran were going to come to an agreement on all these things. And then third, it was just smart. You don't want to have these other issues on the table that would then give the Iranians leverage over the nuclear issue, where they would be trading, I don't know, support for Hamas for more centrifuges. Mm-hmm. So it was the smart play, and I think the results have proven that. We got a very good deal. We still have these other issues with Iran, but we have other ways to deal with those.
Yeah, it seems to me in negotiation, when you add side deals and smaller issues, you add the ones that you expect agreement on to begin to get kind of a lot of nodding heads as you negotiate the tougher issues.
Exactly.
And what you're saying here is these other issues were as difficult or more than the nuclear one, so they would have been done exactly the opposite.
Sure. Yes. And what you had, you see, on the nuclear deal was international unity. You could bring all these other countries in who were willing to put extreme sanctions on Iran because of the nuclear program, and they weren't going to do that for any of the other issues. That, you know, they're all over the map on whether they like Iran supporting Hamas or Hezbollah.
Right.
Get it? So this was your maximum opportunity. You had the most U.S. cards to use in negotiating this deal, and you heard people say at the time that this was the best national security agreement negotiated in a generation, and that is still true. And the main opposition to it comes, one, for political reasons. Mm-hmm. They didn't want a Democratic president to get the credit for this. And then there's a subset, the ideologues. The people didn't mm-hmm. want to make any kind of deal with this regime because they want to overthrow the regime. Mm-hmm. And most Americans would be appalled at the idea that our strategy in the Middle East is to go start another war.
Exactly. Overthrow another regime we don't like. Finally, before we move on, if you were going to give one last bit of advice to Rex Tillerson, what would it be? On Iran.
If you want to improve the deal, go negotiate improvements to the deal. This, you can do what the Iran nuclear deal showed, is that you can do business with these people. It's hard, but you can do business. And for many, many of our issues in the Middle East, you need Iran. You need Iranian cooperation to stabilize Iraq, to defeat the Taliban in Afghanistan, to bring peace to Yemen, and ultimately to arrive at a Middle East peace deal. There's no way you're going to be pushing Iran back into the box they were in before we overthrew Saddam Hussein. Our interventions in the Gulf have made a mess of the Middle East. You need Iran's help to try to put the pieces back together.
And the idea that Congress might, the hawkish folks in Congress, the ideologues in Congress, might want to add more sanctions, I guess you'd say, Secretary Tillerson, see if you can keep them from doing that.
Exactly. There is room for more sanctions on, for example, Iran's support for some terrorist groups or their missile tests, which are not covered by the nuclear agreement. And so we'd have to negotiate something separately on that. But you don't want to do it in such a way that you reimpose some of the sanctions we just waived. I don't know if your listeners know. In exchange for them rolling back their program, then freezing it and putting it under a camera, we then waived some of the sanctions that we put on them until they would do these actions. So they took these actions, so we're waiving them, the Europeans are waiving them, the Chinese, so you can now do business with Iran. We still have unilateral sanctions that prohibit most U.S. companies from doing it. But if you then go try to slap those very same sanctions back on, that will be a violation of the deal.
Sure.
That will break the deal. That means Iran can then walk away from the agreement. We would have lost the international unity that put the sanctions on in the first place. There would be no restrictions on their nuclear program. We'd be off to the races, and the only option you would have there would be war.
Okay. So that's Iran, India, and Pakistan. Is there any news with either of them? What is the status of these two nuclear rivals?
This is really the uncovered crisis. The nuclear arms race in South Asia is perhaps the most dangerous area of the world. You have two nuclear-armed rivals who have fought four wars, if you count the Kargil crisis, together, have unresolved territorial disputes, have extremists in both countries that want a war with the other side. And in the case of Pakistan, a collapsing economy, an unstable government, ISIS and al-Qaeda groups operating within their national territory, it's really a recipe for disaster. And over the last 6 months, the fighting between the two over the Kargil border, the disputed territory between the two, has actually increased. You've had Pakistani or Pakistani-related groups going into India and killing Indian soldiers. You had India conducting its first cross-border raid into Pakistan territory. So it's calmed down a bit in the last month or two, but it still remains a tense situation. And if there is a military confrontation with those two states, it is very likely to go nuclear.
Mm. And so what's the advice there?
The U.S. is really ignoring this crisis, and unfortunately the Trump administration has left the State Department positions that deal with this vacant. Rex Tillerson is basically home alone at the State Department. None of the senior positions have been filled. By the way, same at Defense. Of the 50 positions at Defense, Trump has only appointed one. That's the Secretary. So you have this sort of deterioration of the State Department. Trump plans to cut the State Department budget by 30%. These are the people that deal with crises like this. We don't have an ambassador to India. We don't have an ambassador to Pakistan. These people have been recalled and not replaced. You're basically strapping one hand behind your back and covering your eyes with a blindfold. So the main advice is staff up, get professionals back in, focus on this. Don't let this situation drift.
So you're in Washington. You talk to people who know what's going on. You have coffee, right? Do people think that's going to happen? I mean, what it strikes me, because I kind of knew what you were saying was true, but I hadn't heard it as clearly as you said it. It feels like what we have is an administration that almost thinks of itself as a media company. So we pay attention to what gets headlines, and we don't even have anyone on the back burner paying attention to what might not. So your answer when I said, do people think this is going to happen, your answer is no?
No. I mean, on national security and foreign policy, there are Trump supporters who keep insisting everything is all right, but everyone else is somewhere between extremely concerned and a sense of panic about what's going on. About the common view is that this administration does not have a foreign policy. It does not have a national security policy. What it has is a set of impulses. And there doesn't even seem to be coordination between the president and his chief people, like Mattis or Tillerson. They will say they will give contradictory statements on the very same day about key foreign policy issues. The National Security Council, which is supposed to be coordinating this, is just riven with feuding. And one of the key strategists, Stephen Bannon, is a person that doesn't want the State Department to be staffed up. He wants to, as he says, deconstruct the administrative state. He sees the State Department as a rival and doesn't want it to be increased, which is, of course, insane. But
insane.
You know, yeah. It's insane. Yes, this is not what the show is about, but there is deep concern about the stability of the president, about whether he knows what's going on. It appears that he does not. He does not know the level of his ignorance, and he appears to get most of his news from TV, not from the intelligence briefings, not from the professionals in the Department of State or Defense, and he probably has drawn the wrong lessons from the military strikes in Syria and the dropping of the massive ordnance bomb on Afghanistan, which is that you do things like this and you get good poll numbers. Your popularity goes up. You appear strong. Will he take that lesson into the crisis with North Korea? Is this what he thinks he wants to do? So a man who's been impulsively tweeting is now impulsively firing missiles, and that could lead to a major conflict in Iran or in North Korea. And meanwhile, these other crises like South Asia are just not getting attention.
Wow. So you have the country that still remains the most powerful, the most influential, and yet not paying attention to whole areas of the world and not even staffed so that if something flares up somewhere like that, I mean, what happens? Is a sudden scramble between Bannon and Kushner and Tillerson and Trump, and they all say different things, and Trump does whatever impulse strikes him?
So you have career officials, you know, acting in assistant secretary positions and acting in deputy secretary positions, for example. But that's not the same as having your team, having the people that you trust, have the people that you're coordinating, that agree on your policy, being able to quickly implement something. So what you're, in a case of a crisis, you would get, you know, all kinds of opinions, and there wouldn't be a clear leadership plan for how to approach this. You know, you may think, and I do, I think, and you may think, that the George W. Bush administration was catastrophic, that the invasion of Iraq was the worst strategic blunder in U.S. history and has set us back decades. But at least they had a competent team doing it. They were all in sync on this, and that's why they were able to do it. you know.
Wrong choice.
Powell and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld. These guys were all in sync, all operating together, and they were fully staffed. There's nothing like that with Trump, and so that's why you worry when you get into a crisis with North Korea that he's going to act by impulse, not by any kind of plan, strategy, and may not even understand the consequences of military action in North Korea. He may think that he has a quick, clean, momentarily popular option of, say, knocking out a missile that they're going to test by preemptively launching a strike. Has he thought about what happens next? There's no indication that he thinks that way.
Mm-hmm. And one thing which you referred to was a question of mine. Do you believe Trump deliberately raises fears of war simply to save a failing presidency? That as you point out, if one were to say what actions since he's taken office have gotten the most respect and praise across the board, not just from his side, it is the military strikes.
Yes, it is. Even though, you know, I was surprised to see how few of the public actually approved that. Depending on which poll, it's like 51% or 57% supported the strike. Interestingly, when you break it down by party, the same percentage of Democrats who supported a strike on Syria with Obama, which is about 38-40%, supported the strike with Trump. The difference is the Republicans, who opposed it overwhelmingly under Obama and support it overwhelmingly under Trump. So this is a tactic, this military strength, this show of force that works effectively to, at the very least, shore up his base and to win over some in the moderate middle. So that's, you are really worried about a...
Yeah, now one of the things that...
wag the dog scenario.
Exactly. One of the things that I had thought about, expressed some thoughts about, was that when he was on a winning streak, and I would say that winning streak lasted through every bit of the campaign, the election, post-election, and maybe the first thing was the judge stopping the travel ban, and then there were a series of defeats. I was afraid that if he was on an absolute winning streak, he would begin to believe that he was the chosen one and that I violated the rules every day and I got nothing but success. So that scared me. But now what you have is a string of misfortune, the travel bans, the Health Care Act, et cetera, so that now if he needs victories, the one place where he sort of can act unilaterally and not have countervailing forces is on these military strikes, even though, as some have pointed out, the strike in Syria was unconstitutional. There was no way you could justify it from the initial authorization act for Iraq.
Right. And this is, of course, something that other presidents have turned to when they're facing domestic challenges.
Grenada, for instance, right?
Because this is what they could do. What's that?
Grenada.
Well, for example, Ronald Reagan, right?
Reagan was having a tough time, and suddenly he attacks Grenada?
Well, and we lost 156 troops in the bombing of the Beirut Marines barracks.
Yeah.
And so he pulled the troops out of Lebanon. It was a humiliating disaster. And in part, to cover that disaster, he goes and invades Grenada under the pretext of saving some college students who were down there. Clinton, when he was under impeachment threat, launched cruise missile attacks on Saddam Hussein. Richard Nixon, when he was under increasing impeachment threat during the Watergate scandal, brought the country to DEFCON 3 because what he said was rising tensions in the Middle East. So this is a very tempting ploy for presidents under pressure.
So we found ourselves into talking about Trump and the administration, and you certainly all along have voiced your concern about a president who acts intemperately, who, I think you said, can a tweet start a war? And you said, you know, perhaps it could. And that basically what he says either shows a little understanding of the complexity of the situation or wrong understanding, which gives him the benefit of the doubt that it isn't a lie, that he just doesn't know. But when he in the presidential campaign was asked about other countries acquiring nuclear weapons, right? And he said, that, I'm quoting Trump, you know what? We're better off if Japan protects itself against this maniac in North Korea. We're better off, frankly, if South Korea is going to start to protect itself. Saudi Arabia, sure, it's going to happen. It's going to happen anyway. It's only a question of time. And you point out that that, as you've said before, more countries have given up nuclear weapons, nuclear programs over the last 30 years than have tried to acquire them. This is either a myth or just absolute misinformation.
Right. But he doesn't understand history. He doesn't understand basic U.S. strategy. He says it's inevitable they're going to get them. No, that's not true at all. Decades of Republican and Democratic policy have stopped the spread of these weapons, not completely, but slowed it. And if we can actually resolve North Korea, if we can get a permanent solution to Iran, we will have stopped the proliferation of these weapons. There are no other states knocking on the door. And no U.S. president has ever helped another country get it. Even our allies, we didn't want Great Britain to get it in the 50s. We didn't want France to get it in the 60s. We didn't want Israel to get it in 68. We actively opposed them getting those programs. So when Trump says this, he's turning 70 years of bipartisan policy on its head, just disregarding it because of what? A gut instinct, a feeling, a mistaken historical analysis? This is the danger of a president like this.
So what is your sense of U.S.-Russia relations as it pertains to nuclear weapons, nuclear threats?
Well,
I read that one headline about
Russia remains the one country where they could destroy us as a nation. They have, as I said, 4,000 weapons. 1,000 of them are on missiles poised for immediate launch.
How many do we have by the way? How many? We have 1,000 poised for immediate launch?
About 1,000 on missile, but it's actually around 900 on ICBMs that we have scattered around the Great Plains and in the West.
On high alert?
And we have at least two submarines on high alert at all times, one in the Atlantic, one in the Pacific, ready to launch. Trump, as president, has the sole authority to launch nuclear weapons. No one else can do it. And he cannot be contradicted. Once he gives the order, it has to be obeyed. There's no vote. Doesn't have to be a cabinet meeting. Doesn't have to be a consultation. There's no congressional role, of course. And he can give an order, and 4 minutes later, those missiles start flying. As Richard Nixon once said, I can walk into my office, pick up the phone, and in 30 minutes, 70 million people would be dead. So Trump has this immense power under his control, and so does Putin. So this is what makes the U.S.-Russia nuclear relationship still extremely dangerous. In fact, I would say it's more dangerous now than it was under Obama because of the intemperate,
the volatile,
unpredictable, unstable president we now have.
Right.
And the relationship with Russia, unsurprisingly, is not getting better.
Right.
Even though Russia helped elect Donald Trump, Putin may be having buyer's remorse at this point because it is not working out as planned.
Right. And whether that's the feeling on the part of the Trump administration that they have to show they're not Putin's puppet, or who knows. But yeah, that's what I think is where we think of Putin perhaps as somewhat volatile, but I think I mean when we look at his work in the Ukraine, Chechnya, Crimea, and so on, it looks like he does have a plan.
Yes, he does. More calculating. This guy has a strategy and he's implementing it.
Right, but now when we take what was probably the most the most measured president I can remember in Obama, and replace him with the most volatile, that changes the equation. What would your advice be on that front, the Russia front?
Well, my advice would be to take Putin up on his suggestion. Remember the phone call that he had with Putin right after becoming president where he got into a, according to reports, he got into an argument with him about the nuclear agreement, the New START treaty.
Right.
He said, well, of course you like that. It gave you everything you wanted. No, no, it didn't. It was a completely balanced, modest little agreement. Putin would like to extend that agreement because, like many agreements, like the Iran agreement, there's a limit on it. It actually expires in a couple of years. It was only a five-year agreement. So you have to renew it. Well, you could take the option of lowering the number of nuclear weapons on both sides. The Joint Chiefs are perfectly comfortable with this. They've already said we could cut our arsenal by a third and still implement all the military missions. It would solve some of Mattis's problems. We don't have enough money. Even if there is a military budget increase, we don't have enough money to pay for all the weapons on order. So you could save some money on nuclear weapons and use it for the other programs. Putin has his own budget problems, so this would be good for him. So there is a deal there to be made to make a big cut in U.S.-Russian forces. This is actually one of the bright spots. This is something Trump could do and do very easily, and he'd have Republican Party support for it, and the Democrats would go along.
Yeah.
And I'm still holding out the possibility that this could happen. Remember, it's only 100 days so far.
Yeah,
lot of things can happen in an administration.
Yeah, of course, what goes through my head as you're saying that is who's has his ear on what particular day? You know, what has he heard or perhaps even read in the last 24 hours or 48 hours that leads him to make a decision or lead in a direction? And we don't know. So let's talk about North Korea. By the way, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund. And the Plowshares Fund is...
it's a foundation that raises money from generous individuals and then gives it out as grants to the smartest people with the best ideas on how to reduce nuclear threats.
Okay.
We've been doing it for 36 years now.
And the website is Plowshares, and as Joe said, written the English way, P-L-O-U-G-H. S-H-A-R-E-S, plowshares.org. And it comes from the biblical reference, turn their swords into plowshares, right?
Yes, and their spears into pruning hooks. Although I was interviewed by Stephen Colbert, and he said, you know, that's a little misleading, because I know for a fact you can mess somebody up pretty good with a pruning hook.
Yes. So what's going on with North Korea? What's business as usual, and what's new and different?
What's new in the last 2 years, and this is independent of Trump, is that Kim Jong-un, the volatile, unpredictable, impulsive dictator of North Korea, has accelerated their nuclear and missile programs. So they've done more tests of missiles and nuclear weapons in the last 3 years than they've done in the whole rest of the program combined. And they've been moving on this stuff for decades. First went nuclear under Bush, did more tests under Obama, and so they're accelerating. And they do not have a missile that can hit the United States yet. They can hit South Korea, they can hit Japan with a probably nuclear-armed missile, but they can't hit us, but they're working on it. And all the experts I know believe that they will get that capability. It's just a question of when. 4 years, many people think that's likely. A little longer, maybe it's 5, 6, but they're working on it. So you got to stop them. And this is what's pressing the issue. There are ways to do that. There are tools you have at your disposal. But Trump has said he will not allow this to happen. And when it looked like they were going to do a nuclear test on April 15th, this is the anniversary of the founder, his grandfather's birthday, he said there was a fear that he was going to take a preemptive strike. So you've raised the military tensions in the region without really a plan for what you would do, and if you started military conflict, how would you end it? As they say, tell me how this ends. And North Korea did not test. They had a failed missile test, but they didn't test the nuclear bomb, but they are going to. They are not going to stop. They are continue their testing for both. And so it's just a question of when they do it, and then what will the U.S. response be? And when you've committed yourself this way, like Trump has, you really are in what they call the commitment trap. If you don't take strong action, you look weak. Your credibility suffers. So that's the situation we're in now. It's as one of my colleagues says, it's like a slow motion Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
People are moving forces in. People are taking military steps, and there's no diplomatic effort yet to try to resolve this by talks rather than military force.
Okay. Now, with Iran, we can say all we want about them, but they are a stable regime. They are someone with whom sanctions and removal of sanctions to allow them to do business, help them economically. There's leverage there. At least the appearance, sort of in the public imagination, is that we don't necessarily have any leverage with the leader in North Korea.
Well, we have limited leverage. I mean, we don't do business with North Korea. We've put sanctions on, but there's two things you can do more of. And one is there actually are more sanctions we could put on that would target specifically the leadership bank accounts, their ability to do business. And there are, and that's the kind of thing people are talking about, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that, more focused, direct sanctions that freeze them out of the international banking system. And the other, of course, is China.
I was just going to say, my next question, what role can China play, and what do you expect them to play?
Well, they can't play the role that so many on the right, like the Charles Krauthammer column says. The goal of U.S. policy, he says, is to put pressure on China so that they will clamp down on North Korea. Well, it's true that China is the major economic partner and enabler of North Korea.
As Russia Russia was with Cuba during the missile crisis,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And even more so, yeah. I mean, the Chinese and the North Koreans used to talk about the relationship as lips to teeth, lips and teeth, they used to say. Well, relations have been strained because of Kim Jong-un, and mainly, in part, because of him killing officials in his own government who were linked to China, friendly to China, or like his half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, who he killed in the Kuala Lumpur airport by spraying VX on him, was under Chinese protection. Yes, right.
I didn't know
that. Michael Corleone knocking off Fredo,
yeah.
You know, who was under his mother's protection. His mother died. Anyway, so the Chinese are not happy with Kim Jong-un. This is not part of their plan. They do not want a military buildup or certainly a military crisis. And so they are willing to clamp down, but they're not going to clamp down so much that the regime collapses, which is the Krauthammer fantasy, John Bolton fantasy, that this is how you solve the problem. China removes the regime. No way, because even though they don't like what's going on, what they really fear is a collapsed regime that leads to chaos in the peninsula, millions of North Koreans fleeing into China, destabilizing those provinces, South Korea possibly moving up and taking over with North Korea, having a unified Korea, maybe with nuclear weapons now, but certainly allied to the U.S. That is not a scenario they want. So what the Chinese are telling us is they're willing to do more, they're willing to squeeze more, but the U.S. has got to be willing to talk to North Korea. The only way to solve this, they say, is through negotiations. And a lot of us, a lot of Korean experts, North Korean experts, believe that's true. There is a deal to be made. It's kind of like the Iran deal. You can't get North Korea to give up their weapons right now. That horse left the barn a long time ago. Maybe you could have got that 10, 15 years ago. You can't get it now. But you can freeze it. You can freeze the program. What my colleague Sig Hecker, the former director of Los Alamos Laboratory, says is you get the three no's. No new weapons, no more weapons, no export of weapons. You do that, and you've solved a lot of the U.S. national security concerns. That's a deal that could be struck.
Why didn't Obama make it?
He bobbled it. I am deeply critical of the Obama policy on this. They had something they call strategic patience. They thought they could outwait them. They said that the only way we're going to talk is if the Koreans agree that the purpose of the talk is the denuclearization of the peninsula. that the purpose of the talk is to get them to give up their program. There was no way
that
North Koreans were going to agree to
that. That was not going to be.
So we didn't have negotiations. And
that
what
wasn't,
happened?
Yeah.
They sped up their program.
Yeah. So that they were making a precondition be
exactly
the eventual outcome they wanted.
They were afraid of looking weak.
Yeah.
They were already taking heat because of their agreement with Iran,
yep.
And they didn't. They basically made a political calculation
yeah.
that they couldn't do two of these.
So you and other experts believe there is a deal to be made. China would do some leaning in the background while that negotiation's going on. Is that kind of the thought?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe not so much in the background.
Mm-hmm.
After Kim Jong Nam's assassination, they cut off their import of coal.
That's right.
So that's one of the big things that North Korea exports is coal to China. It accounts for 35% of their earnings. China stopped buying it. And there was nothing secret about it.
So where do we stand today? And if you were a betting man, where do you think we're moving in the next few months?
Well, I am completely out of the prediction business. I mean, after the November election, clearly I have no idea what's going on. I don't think there's any, and this is what differs between the Middle East and Iran and the Syria strike. I don't think there's any Department of Defense official who will be recommending military action against North Korea to the president, especially Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, even Tillerson. There'll be talk about this, but in the end, there's no winning hand here. The difference between Syria and North Korea is if you hit North Korea, they hit back. And they have enough conventional force, the artillery and rockets and missiles, on their border to devastate Seoul. Estimates are that hundreds of thousands of South Koreans would die in the first hours of combat. So that's what makes the military option impossible. There's no quick fix here. So what do I think is going to happen? There's going to be continued bobbling and missteps by the Trump administration. There's going to continue to be provocations by the North Koreans. There probably will be another test. There'll be more military bluster. And the best case is actually like the Cuban Missile Crisis. At this point, we get the intervention, the help of China. And we arrange talks. We arrange talks with the North Koreans, unconditional, but with some understanding that it could lead to a freeze in their program. That is, I'm an optimist, so I think that is what will happen.
Yeah.
But you have two inexperienced, relatively untested and impulsive presidents with immense military power, or leaders, I should say,
yeah.
with Kim Jong-un and Trump, with immense military power at their disposal, both of whom make foreign policy decisions based on domestic political considerations. So it makes this highly unpredictable and highly uncertain.
And that's just the reality at this moment, right?
Yes.
That scenario, that positive scenario you put out there, is if things get worse and people get more frightened, that maybe both China and the U.S. Sanity will rule, and serious talks will happen.
Right. Once the president realizes there isn't a winning military option.
Okay.
But it requires a lot.
Right.
He has to realize that.
That's right. And he has to realize that the repercussions of an impulse in this regard are almost unthinkable.
And I would say, but this opinion is nearly universal among North Korean experts, both Republicans, Democrats, liberals, people who really understand North Korea. And there's plenty of Republican North Korean experts that would help Donald Trump negotiate this if he would just freaking hire them and bring them into the State Department.
Okay. And so in addition to plowshares.org, any other websites you'd send people to learn more about what's going on?
Oh, one of the best out there is what people we support. It's called 38 North. They do some of the best analysis, including some great analysis of satellite surveillance of them. And there's a particularly good group of people at the Middlebury Institute out in Monterey, and you can see their work by going up to something called Arms Control Wonk, armscontrolwonk.org, where they have lots of discussions about all this. And those are two of the best resources.
38 North and Arms Control Wonk.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Joe Cirincione, and keep up the good work. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencmcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Please share this podcast widely. I look forward to being with you again soon.